galaxy clusters will be my subject now. I enjoyed doing this work with Kandu Subramanian and Niels Haugen. We only have electronic, right? I know, look at this, there's a human stick, normal stick, right? And Kandu Subramanian and Niels Haugen. So first outline. But I prepared this slide was the first thing after the title. But then I realized that all my talk will be just an outline. With the 15 minutes that I have, I will just give you the general outline of this work. And the outline meaning that I will be making statements. I will not have much time to present arguments. So be prepared. But I would be just pleased to discuss the arguments after the talk or any other time during this conference. So galaxy clusters. These are the biggest physically definable units in the universe. This is the central part of a coma cluster, one of the classical objects of this family of objects. It's a very rich cluster of galaxies. Here, virtually every spot of light here is a galaxy. Within this field of view, which is a very central part of the cluster, there are a few thousand of galaxies. So, and each galaxy, look at this, for example, this is clearly a disk spiral galaxy, similar to the Milky Way. So just to establish the scales, I will be using the unit of length called kiloparsec. One kiloparsec is 3 × 10^21 centimeters, or roughly 3,000 light years. About 3,000 light years, 1 kiloparsec. So this distance here, from here to here, is about 10 kiloparsecs. So you see the scale of the problem we have, right? So the size, typical size, from maybe somewhere here to somewhere there is about 1 megaparsec. This is a typical scale of a cluster of galaxies. Now, this is the image of the same cluster, but now with X-rays. X-rays are produced by a hot gas, which fills the space between the galaxies. This rectangle corresponds to this whole field, right? So you see that this object and these two are here. So you see a core, well, original X-ray observations, which had lower sensitivity, they weren't revealing this non-axisymmetric part. And people believed that these clusters just represent spheres of hot gas in hydrostatic equilibrium. The gravity is provided by the stars and dark matter, and the hot gas resides in this gravitational potential well. But then better observations, new observations in X-rays, reveal that most clusters, if not all, are very far from being in equilibrium. We live in an important epoch in the history of the universe. The planets around us have been formed a long time ago. Of course, there are some planets being formed elsewhere, or stars, but it's not interesting, because planets and stars are being formed in the galaxy all the time, right? There are always new stars being formed and stars dying. Galaxies also have mostly been formed some time ago, and now we see their relatively slow evolution. These objects now are just in the state of formation. We now evidence the epoch of cluster formation. These clusters are just being formed by agglomeration of smaller clumps of matter. So we are lucky people. We're living in the right epoch. This epoch will continue another billion years, so no need to worry, no need to rush. And we have another billion years to evidence this miraculous phenomenon. So these clusters of galaxies are filled with a hot gas, first fact which I want to make clear. Second, they are interesting objects. They're evolving objects. They keep evolving. So now I will start talking about magnetic fields in these objects. And then we have a challenge. There are parameters, right? There are some parameters of the gas here, typical parameters. Speed of sound, 1,000 kilometers per second, perhaps one of the most important parameters. So now I want to discuss the behavior of magnetic field in an evolving object, which is interesting, right? The sun, the Earth, or the magnet, or the galaxy are in a quasi-steady state. These objects are not. They keep evolving. So what will happen with magnetic field? Is there any magnetic field? Yes, there is a clear evidence of magnetic fields in these clusters. First, a handful of clusters directly show synchrotron emission, which is produced by relativistic particles gyrating in magnetic field. Therefore, synchrotron emission, which has a very clear observation signature. It's very, very difficult to confuse synchrotron emission with any other emission. It has very steep and power law spectrum. It is an observed in a very small number of clusters. So it does show that clusters can have magnetic field, but it wasn't clear if all or many or some of them have this magnetic field. And we were arguing quite since a long time ago that in those clusters where there is no synchrotron emission, it is absent not because there is no magnetic field, but because there are no cosmic rays. And the basis for this statement was just the general experience we all share. Because if there is gas, if there is turbulence in this gas, there must be magnetic field. Any random motion of a conducting gas produces magnetic field via at least small-scale dynamo action. So this immediately makes you to think that if there is a gas, if it's turbulent, anything around us is turbulent, right? There must be magnetic, and indeed, more recently, there were observations of further rotation through the clusters, which confirmed that much larger number of clusters, virtually, I think, maybe every one where the such measurements have been tried, possess magnetic field. This further rotation measure is the integral of the product of magnetic field along the line of sight. So there's this cluster, I'm sitting here. The magnetic field along the line of sight weighted with thermal electron density, and this is integrated along the line of sight. This is, so it depends on magnetic field integrated along the line of sight. And this is the impact parameter. People observed background sources behind, which are seen through the cluster, at different distances from the cluster center. And measured this RM, further rotation measure, which is proportional to the integral of magnetic field, and plotted as a distance to the impact parameter. And we see here the further schedule, well, there is a schedule. Further rotation is more or less random, but there is a clear trend. These black dots correspond to those sources which are not projected on the clusters at all, the control sample. And it's clear that the closer you are to the cluster center, the larger further orientation you get. But it is random. And there are other arguments indicating that magnetic field in the clusters is random. There is no magnetic field at the scale of the whole cluster. Again, with the experience we have here, no surprise, right? As soon as I'm telling you that these clusters don't rotate, they don't show any evidence of large-scale rotation, you'll not be interested in listening to me anymore, right? There can be no large-scale field, come on. Of course not. Of course it must be random. Of course it must be random. And it is. It is random. The scale of this magnetic field is all of the galactic size. So it is really small. So if we are returned back here, so the scale of magnetic field in this galaxy is of about that big, the size of a galaxy. It's a very tangled, small-scale magnetic field. But still, it needs to be explained. I heard the arguments where people say, the argument was the following. These clusters of galaxies, like elsewhere in the universe, the electric conductivity of this plasma is so high that you don't need anything to explain magnetic fields. If they are, well, everything is magnetized, right? So when these clusters were formed, most probably there was some magnetic field. It was captured by the collapsing cloud of gas, which is now has become the cluster of galaxies, and that's it. With higher magnetic Reynolds number, its lifetime will be larger than Hubble time, the age of the universe. Is it enough or not? No, it's not. Because these objects are turbulent. and the lifetime magnetic field in a turbulent system is not equal to the ohmic diffusion time. It's equal to the energy transfer time along the spectrum. It's equal to the one addition over time. If I have a magnetic field at this scale, in one addition over time it will be tangled, transferred along the spectrum, and transformed into heat. In one addition over time. So even if RM is high, this just means that the energy transfer along the spectrum is rapid. But in one addition over time, all the energy from the energy range scale will be transferred to heat. Not in ohmic diffusion time, if only the system is turbulent. If only the system is turbulent. And then I think we can make a quite clear statement that a three-dimensional turbulent system, if it is magnetized, must host a dynamo. Because if the system is turbulent, it cannot sustain magnetic field at an integral scale for longer than one addition over time. If still it does have magnetic field, and it is three-dimensional, so the dynamo can work, there must be a dynamo. This immediately tells us that we are surrounded by this dynamo. We are in the middle of this zoo of dynamos, because everything is three-dimensional, everything is turbulent, and everything is magnetized. Gosh, I have only 5 minutes left. So I will be the idea of this talk is to apply absolutely standard theory of fluctuation dynamo to this evolving object, the clusters of galaxies. I will skip these two slides because you know everything better than me. There's some basic facts about fluctuation dynamo. So we can identify three main stages in the evolution of clusters of galaxies and their turbulence and magnetic fields. First, I have to convince myself that there is turbulence. This means that there are sources of energy which can drive turbulence, and second, that the Reynolds numbers are large enough as to maintain a turbulent flow. Second, I have to consider what sort of magnetic field such a turbulence would produce. So first, cluster formation. This is the epoch where we are living now, when clusters are being formed. At that stage, clusters consist of gradually merging blobs of matter, dark matter and gas, of roughly comparable size, maybe comparable to the size of the cluster as a whole. And of course, such impacts will be very turbulent. They will produce lots of shear, they will be quasi-random. It will be volume-filling flow, which most plausibly can be characterized as turbulent flow. Jim was doing quite useful, impressive simulations on related things, the evolution of magnetic field in such flows. So just imagine, say, two or three blobs of matter of roughly equal mass approaching each other along random trajectories. Guess how the flow will look. Have you tried, for example, to take Fourier expansion with four modes, the randomly chosen phases and amplitudes? Even with four modes, the sum looks like an absolutely random function, right? So you need two or three blobs to get something which will look indistinguishable from a real random flow. So the estimates you can get from various models tell you that you expect Mach number, random motions with a Mach number of 1/3 and the scale of about 10 galactic sizes. This, most probably Reynolds number will be larger than 100. Here, there's a huge difficulty. There's huge difficulty here. The gas there is collisionless. Now I'm starting telling you more of truth, right? The mean free path in that gas is comparable to the scales I'm talking about, 10 kiloparsecs. Okay, I can start waving my hands now. I will say that Bragdinsky will mention gyro radius that replaces the mean free path in magnetized medium. But still, all the effects Jim was mentioning immediately come to the face. They will never explode in full in this application. Alex Chikochikin is doing very interesting things in this direction now. And I hope we will hear more from you. It's a really interesting and promising subject. So there is a huge caveat here. But there is observational evidence, some observational evidence for turbulence in clusters. So I can at least, even if I'm unable to suggest you a convincing theory, at least I can refer to observations, saying that it should be turbulent. Okay, during this period, magnetic field can be amplified by a factor of 3,000, and it will produce magnetic sheets of just right sort of thickness, about galactic scale sheets of filaments. And then there is decay, and this is an interesting period. Suppose the mergers have ended. No more significant infall of matter. And then, what will happen then? The turbulence will start decaying. There is nothing to support the turbulence. But the turbulence, unlike a laminar flow, decays as a power law in time, because the decay is nonlinear. The energy is dissipated at short wavelengths, at dissipation scale. And the energy supply there depends on energy itself, because there's a turbulence cascade. The result is that the energy evolution, dE by dT, depends on the power of energy, which results in power law decay in time, rather than exponential. Anyway, we made some reasonable calculations to calculate what will happen during this stage of decay of turbulence. There can be further amplification by a factor of 20. And then finally, there will be one more stage when the mergers have ended. The turbulence after the merger has decayed. What will happen then? Still, there will be galaxies and smaller blobs of matter raining down on this cluster. And these objects will be leaving behind them turbulent wakes. This is a recent simulation of the motion with Mach number 0.9 moving through a cluster. And this is a photograph with the famous book of Van Dyck, which I really like, the algebra of fluid motion. Turbulent wake of the type for example, described by Prandtl theory. And then you take Prandtl's solution for turbulent wakes. You estimate where Reynolds number along the wake becomes as small as the critical Reynolds number, whatever it is, say 1,000. And you know the length of the turbulent wake. Look at this. The length of the wake depends on the third power of the Reynolds number, which is poorly known. Now we can calculate the volume filling factor and area covering factor of the waves. And you see that filling factor in volume will be very small, but the area covering factor can be close to one. Quite a curious situation. This means that we have a cluster, which is, well, quasi-spherical thing. And even though the separation of waves in three dimensions is very large, they almost uniformly cover the whole area. This means that if you observe such an object, your line of sight will be passing through one region, on average, one region with intense turbulence, and vast regions without turbulence. You will have a mixture. Then you can have an object which will have signatures of both turbulent and laminar object, because you see it in two dimensions, so you see a projection. And look here, the filling factor depends on this amazing power, 3, 5, and 4. This means that I change Reynolds number by a factor of 3 to the fourth is two orders of magnitude. And this tells me immediately that this results, on the one hand, they are very sensitive to parameters, which are poorly known. On the one hand, this means that two clusters, which are apparently very similar, can have very different properties, just because Reynolds numbers there differ by 25%. On the other hand, now I think about numerical simulations. What is Reynolds number in numerical simulations? Okay, fine, I have some numerical diffusion, some hyperdiffusion. I distort a little bit, and then I raise this a little bit to the fifth power. So if the situation is such that you do expect that parameters of your solution do depend very sensitively on parameters, you should be twice careful about the numerical approximations, which, or analytical approximations, which otherwise are totally acceptable and generally nice. So to me, I was amazed to see these high powers, and it made me quite worried about the situation with modeling clusters. I must end here. There is a table, a boring table, with all the parameters which we figure out. Well, it's enough to say that they reasonably agree with observations. Otherwise, I won't be here. Thank you.
Okay, we can have a few short questions. Yeah, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, how can you derive the correlation length of the magnetic field based on Faraday rotation? How can you separate?
Just based on Spitzer theory. It's just that.
The correlation.
You mean mean free path? Oh, sorry.
No, the correlation length when you estimate the magnetic field strength from Faraday rotation.
This is a dirty business, of course. This is dirty business. What I'm saying is that normally, in one scale flow from Kazantsev theory, it's L naught Rn to the power minus 1/2. Now, what will happen in a steady state, nobody knows. But at least there is one model of Kondo-Subramanian, which at least I personally like, where he argues that in the steady state, the Reynolds number will effectively be renormalized to become Rm critical. And then we say that Lb as a steady state will be on the order of the energy range scale times Rm critical to the power minus 1/2. And this Rm critical is a order of 30 or 40. And the resulting magnetic field configuration agrees with what you observe. I'm not claiming that it's the only explanation of the observations. It doesn't prove that the theory is correct. But at least the results you get with this agree with what you observe quite reasonably.
The other question is, you said that from synchrotron emission, you suppose there are not many cosmic rays? Okay, how do you know that? And then how can you get an estimate from the field for the field strength from synchrotron emission if you don't have equipartition?
Well, there is no equipartition, but there are other ways to estimate magnetic field. For example, from inverse Compton, you have the lower limit on magnetic field. But these saturations, I definitely would rely more on theory. I do know that magnetic field should be close to at maximum. At maximum strength, close to competition with kinetic energy. I would rely on this more. And if I will see that this contradicts the assumption of competition with cosmic rays, I would first doubt in the competition with cosmic rays. This is more doubtful than the idea of a competition with kinetic energy. It has much less physical ground than this. Or, for example, what I was showing you, quite many clusters where no synchrotron emission at all is observed. Too far the rotation is there. So obviously there is no competition with cosmic rays at all. They don't emit synchrotron, detectable synchrotron at all, those clusters. Still magnetic fields, they are healthy and normal. There is no synchrotron, no synchrotron. So no detectable, let's be strict, no detectable synchrotron, right? Maybe with SKA they will start observing synchrotron from all clusters, God knows. They hope.
So in your comments, you're mentioning how the mean free path for the gases or the plasmas, the system size, are close to it. And so it makes me think that we're in a dynamical regime where the Boltzmann equation really is governing the dynamics. And just wondering if you might want to comment as to how one might expect different things in that context than what we're used to thinking about when the mean free path is small compared to the system size.
So say it again. You mean including?
The picture I would have is that at any point in space, one would actually have multiple streams of different velocities everywhere locally, and so the dynamics is much different than.
Oh yes, yes. And moreover, the induction equation with which you start doesn't apply. There's no induction equation in kinetic theory, right? So everything becomes different. It's just completely. I'm scared of even thinking about it.
I suddenly got something which I know very well, kinetic theory. Tell me, please, what is the spectral indices? What in synchrotron emission? What do they measure?
Well, synchrotron emission.
Yeah.
They measure the slope of the spectrum, it's part of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I think it's, well, typical of galactic conditions, something like -3 energy range spectrum. Mm. But this is probably mostly controlled by the spectrum of relativistic electrons, right? It doesn't tell you much about magnetic spectrum.
Is it hard X-ray spectrum, you mean, yeah?
Sorry?
Do you measure in hard X-rays or microwave?
No. Hard X-rays are thermal. These are thermal continuous emission. X-rays are thermal. Synchrotron emission is non-thermal.
Yeah, this
but
is
this
micro.
Only tells you something about reduced electrons, in which I honestly am not very much interested. Me personally. There are many other people who study all the cosmic electrons, but not me.
Very interesting, yeah. Okay,
okay, and let's go to the last question.
Regarding your point on the Reynolds number, just a comment, I think the situation is actually worse than what you are, even worse than the one you are saying, because the Reynolds number, because things are collisionless, is really badly defined, because you get first anisotropic diffusion coefficients, which you could kind of mimic with Rankine the fluid regime. But since you get all these sorts of micro instabilities into collisionless regime, the definition of the viscosity is actually almost impossible to get. Because you need to understand all these kinetic dynamics, and therefore all these things with Reynolds number are really pretty badly known and supposed
but then
to
I would
vary.
Say that if it's impossible to get, try to avoid getting it. You know, Zeldovich had this saying, he was quoting one philosopher, that the art of science is to make difficult things unnecessary and those things which you need easy. In Russian, it sounds very nicely. I would say the following, and this, I think, is what Alex Chekhachihin is pursues now. I don't believe when people are telling me the Reynolds number in this system is 10 to the 27th. Such numbers don't exist, only quantum mechanics exist. This means that something will happen, which will generate, say, moreover, at the scales corresponding to the dissipation scale with this high Reynolds number. It's not the domain of MHD or hydrodynamics. It's plasma. Therefore, the applicability of the induction equation ends at much larger scales. Therefore, the smaller scales provide what used to be called, and it became almost a swear word, anomalous resistivity. I would think, and this is what Alex Chekhachihin is doing, and I think he will be, I hope he will be successful in doing that, that all this plasma process will be horrible anisotropic diffusivities and all this stuff. Except a few cases like Jim explained, which couple to MHD directly. All this process will only provide you effective or anomalous resistivities with which these equations will remain heuristically correct. But who knows? This is my hope, but not conviction. But then this estimate will be irrelevant. The only thing I need here is that RM is larger than 35. Would you be generous enough to allow me that, to assume that RM is larger than 35 everywhere, even in this room, right? Oh, no, RM not, Reynolds number here, not RM. Not RM, yes. So RM equal to 35 is a very loose constraint. It's very difficult to avoid satisfying it. And then I don't need more. I only need RM equal to 35. So almost everything here be applicable. 35, I don't require it much.
Okay, let us thank Anwar again. And the next talk by Geoffroy Lisieux.